Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But when you talk to people who work in overdose prevention sites, they also say that the impact is because people can take their time. Because when you're rushing and you have, you know, this, you have your drug and you can't really take your time and split that and say, you know what, I'm just going to do half. I'll wait a little bit. I'll do another half, because you're for sure going to use it all and as quickly as possible, just to make sure that cops don't, you know, find that on you.
How much do you know about harm reduction? And are you aware of overdose prevention sites which are popping up across Canada? Thankfully, we're joined by Mary Lou, who is one of the biggest proponents of this movement, and she literally saved lives, along with a lot of other people in Canada. So thank you so much, Mary Lou, for joining us. You're listening to Stop and Search on Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with Elite UK. And I think this is one of those episodes that's going to change a piece of you after you heard it. It's incredible. Thank you so much, Mary Lou. Here we go. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray. Thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, we're joined by Mary Lou, who is just amazing. Just listen to everything that she gets involved in out in Canada and globally as well. She's pushing the global conversation. And there's so many other people like Mary Lou out in Canada that are literally saving lives as we speak. And there's a quote in this that really, really shook me. Mary Lou says that we're having conversations today for people that we know are going to die tomorrow. If you're in drug policy, then you've seen people die so much. We're at an all-time drug-related deaths. We know people. You know, these aren't just statistics to us. They are people we know. I'm looking out the window as I'm saying this, and every so often you do get those moments in this field where you realise what we're doing, and this is one of them. So this is a special episode for me. Thank you so much, Mary Lou, for joining me on it and speaking about harm reduction and overdose prevention sites. Let's get straight on with this. Mary Lou does all the talking for us. Thank you so much. Right, so if it's okay with you then, is it all right if I can get you to do an introduction?
Yeah, my name is Marie-Lou Gagnon. I'm originally from Montreal, so hence the accent and the Francophone name. I've been a nurse for 16 years. But I ended up doing my graduate degrees and did my PhD, ended up a nursing professor at University of Ottawa initially and now at University of Victoria. And I've done a bunch of things in harm reduction. And what brought me to harm reduction is primarily HIV, because originally I was an HIV nurse. And I can speak to probably a few things that I've done over the past 10 years with respect to harm reduction. But right now, currently, I'm the president of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association, which was founded last year.
So that's going to be my first question, actually, because I've followed your work for quite a while now, because no sort of over-egging the pudding, as it were, but you are such a hard worker in this sector. Unbelievable, genuinely. We all of us in Elite UK take our hat off to you, because you're just incredible. So could you first of all explain what the concept of harm reduction is and what it means? Because it's still, obviously, people in our sector know roughly what it translates to, but I think there are still people that have got a passing interest in drug policy reform that just don't quite understand what harm reduction means, what it entails. So could you give us a little bit of background?
Yeah, and I think there's like no consensus really around like one definition. I think we all kind of understand it and come at it from a different path and with different experiences. But for me, it means looking, for sure, from a healthcare standpoint, looking at the harms created by a system where drugs are prohibited in the first place. So it's understanding that a lot of the harms that we see as healthcare providers are caused by prohibition in the first place, and the creation of a market where drugs are unregulated, where also, you know, stigma is very high and people are finding it challenging to have access to healthcare because of that stigma, right? And they often face significant barriers because of kind of like an abstinence-based frame of mind that is very prevalent in healthcare. So harm reduction needs to start with that understanding of it, because otherwise you may be stuck looking at specifically, for example, just preventing infections. But unless you have kind of like that macro understanding of harm reduction, it will make your work pretty hard, right? Like you need to start from a very kind of high level. And then as nurses, we're very much also interested in participating and improving health and making sure that people have options, like safer spaces where they can use drugs, for example, as opposed to using in a place where they might be alone or have to use equipment that is not necessarily sterile and things like that. But it really starts from an understanding that you're working in a system that creates a lot of harms, and that you're working to diminish that and ultimately to eliminate those harms by transforming a system that is really not working for and I think that's been shown time and time again. So I don't know if that answers your question,
oh, totally.
But it covers a lot of things, and you have to be prepared and committed to really looking at bigger questions. And it goes beyond providing a needle. Yeah.
And that's what's fascinating to me is that, again, you're a nurse. So straight away you come into this from no other position than wanting to make sure that people are safe. Because quite often what can happen in our broad subject is that if you're slightly cynical, if you're a politician that doesn't necessarily subscribe to the reforms that we may be talking about, they may think there's some kind of agenda behind it. But when you've got healthcare professionals like yourself, over in this country, we had the British Medical Journal that came out and said we need to legalise and regulate all drugs for the sake of harm reduction. Surely that's a difficult voice to argue with.
Exactly. Yeah, and I truly believe in the power of all different voices coming together. And of course, what needs to be at the center of calls for drug policy reform and for improvement in healthcare services needs to be the people that are experiencing these services and that know what works for them. And I would never, you know, kind of side that for a voice of a healthcare provider. But I think if we all kind of center that around the experience of people who use drugs, and then as allies, really show up, right? And use that voice strategically. It's extremely powerful. And I think there's different sectors that could be doing that a lot more, I would say. Like the healthcare professionals could be doing a lot more, I would say, advocacy and using that voice strategically, because it is powerful, right? And for politicians that may not be educated on the topic first, and then also have their own biases and their own assumptions and their own experiences and also like their own agenda, right? And they, you know, of course, see expertise differently, and you can kind of play with that to change their mind, but you have to do that strategically with an understanding of the system and what's ultimately your goal. But that voice can be very powerful. Yeah,
you hit upon a point there that's so crucial, and this is something, because we recently recorded with the British Medical Journal, and one of the things that we all talked about was the fact that we're still, particularly in this country, and you may be able to speak differently there, but we're not listening to the voice of the drug consumer. We're still talking over them. What is the conversation like there?
Yeah, I think in Canada, especially right now, the groups that actually represent people who use drugs are very, very strong. They are often, I would say, you know, at the table with decision makers, they're at the meetings, they're producing very important documents. Like, that just came out yesterday. I don't know if you got a chance to see the document that came out of the Canadian Associations of People Who Use Drugs on a safe drug supply and actually kind of debunking the concept of it and providing guidance. So I think the organization, their voice is very strong, but, you know, unfortunately, I think it's still is not necessarily standard practice to center what we do, and especially around policies, around their experience, and making sure that you know, policies can't be developed from the top down. Like, they really need to start from the ground up, and you really need to consult with people who use drugs to understand, even if your policies are well-intentioned and you've done the research and it makes sense to you, it may actually make no sense to the people who use drugs. So I don't think we're there yet where, in terms of creating policies, that this is a standard, right?
And that's really funny you say that, actually, about the reform structure, because one of the questions I do tend to ask a live audience is, do they believe in a top-down approach or a bottom-up approach? And it seems to me that people in our sector that's a bit more public health focused, we tend to think bottom-up, whereas it can be a consensus in certain other realms, political realms, or certainly in the cannabis world, people that are now invested in the industry, they believe in a top-down. And I think that's potentially where, if we turn this as a debate, where it may be splitting a little bit, where I think that people like ourselves are very much, we have to be confronted with the drug, not confronted, that's the wrong term, but we have to be there listening to the drug consumer, because we're formulating policies that are going to hopefully benefit them. So therefore, as you said, they need to be at the table. So presumably, as you mentioned there, there is a good network and good voice and consensus there of drug networks and consumers.
Yeah, and a good example of that would be, for example, our governments here decided, as a response to what they call the opioid crisis, we call this an overdose crisis because people are dying, is that they came up with this idea that we should really focus our efforts on monitoring prescriptions of opiates on the part of physicians. And even if you go beyond, let's say, people who use like illicit drugs, like people who experienced chronic pain were never consulted on this, and people who use illicit drugs were also never consulted about like the unintended effects that could create for them. And then you know, we're now experiencing the effects of that, where physicians are cutting off people, they're restricting their prescriptions, people are being driven to, you know, actually buy off the streets, and that contributes, you know, to a risk for overdosing and dying. And it's just like, it's a big mess, basically, to put it simply. But that could have been prevented by actually a careful, you know, consultation process with people who are directly impacted and know what that means for them. And so now we're kind of faced with physicians who are scared of losing their license, like, and we're going to be stuck with that for a long time, unfortunately. So that's kind of like one harmful thing that could have been prevented.
You mentioned just a minute ago about legislation, or that's been at least spoken about. Was that about how there potentially could be regulated fentanyl and things like that? Is that correct?
When I was talking about the document that came out yesterday, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, the document that came out yesterday, there's two documents that came out on the same day. We're pretty much at this stage now in Canada, especially in British Columbia, where we're calling for a safer drug supply. There is no way out of this overdose crisis without providing people with safer drugs, and that's ultimately the only thing that's going to work at this point. Fentanyl is everywhere, and so yesterday was a huge day in Canada and British Columbia, because both the Canadian Association of People Use Drugs and the BC Centre on Substance Use released their call for a safer drug supply, and the BCCSU, which is the acronym, they are calling for what's going to look like, if it comes to reality, and hopefully very quickly, like a buyer's club, pretty much based on the idea of what people were doing back in the days of the early days of the HIV epidemic.
That's fascinating, because this is quite often an example that we do use is the buyer's club. We've used it certainly in regards to cannabis and medicinal consumers in this country, how it's very similar to that. So it's fascinating to use that example there, because one of the things that I found, especially following your work, is that there is so much peer-to-peer harm reduction going on. There are people and communities looking out for each other. And that's, I think, and you're going to be better explaining this than me, but I think that that has pushed away quite a long, that mm-hmm. you've managed to get reforms in place because of that movement.
Yeah, I mean, I would say whatever progress we've made since this current federal government has been elected, because prior to that, we were in a very conservative era with two terms of a very conservative government that was anti-harm reduction. So since the Liberals were elected here at the federal level, I do think that the progress that's been made is entirely because of people on the ground, people who use drugs, activists, harm reduction workers, people who open overdose prevention sites when they were risking being arrested, losing their jobs. I would credit that community for every single progress that's been made, because if people are not pushed and if we don't kind of take risks, like nothing happens. And despite all of that, despite, you know, all of this, I think people, especially the international audience, needs to know that in the past 2 years, 10,000 people have died here in Canada. Four people die every day in my province. So that means, like, today we're talking, four people will die. Tomorrow, four people will die. And that's despite what I consider quite a bit of, you know, quote, progress in harm reduction. Like, from the outside, it may look like Canada is a champion, but we are, despite doing that on paper, it might look good, but we are actually failing at addressing this crisis. So I would say the whatever progress has been made, which is, you know, not, obviously not enough because people are dying, but whatever has been made is definitely because of people on the ground.
And this is what it's quite difficult to get across to certain people, is that for certainly people like you, that this isn't a theoretical discussion. You're faced with the people dying literally every day. And it's, how can you not act and try and do something when you're in that position? And as you mentioned, you know, I've never had it put that way before, that we're having this conversation now based on people's deaths tomorrow. And that is so hard hitting, because it's exactly the same here in this country. We've got the all-time record of drug-related deaths at the moment. We're the leaders in Europe, especially up in Scotland. So this is why it's such a privilege to have a conversation with you about the actual tangible reforms that are going in place. And one of the things that really stuck out to us is a pop-up overdose prevention sites. How amazing is that? Can you explain what that is, first of all?
Well, it is amazing. And I have to say, being part of opening one in Ottawa, which is the capital of our country, and Parliament is 5 minutes away, was the best experience of my entire life and my entire career. And I will probably never experience something like that ever again. But, you know, this was a direct response to this crisis, and it started in Vancouver. So in British Columbia, which is the province most affected by this crisis, in April of 2016, they declared a public health emergency. So just to put that in perspective, right, like that's April 2016. Now we're like February 2019, and four people are still dying every day. So just kind of like putting that into perspective. And really nothing quick was being done. It was really bad, and especially in the downtown east side in Vancouver was really being affected, and still is today. And so a bunch of activists on the ground, community people, you know, created this overdose prevention society and then opened the first pop-up. And at that time I came, that was, you know, in the fall, and I flew to Vancouver to actually see what was happening and to volunteer and to see what's going on. Like, what is this pop-up overdose prevention site? How are people managing it? Like, I wanted to be part of it and see it and learn from it. And I didn't know that a year later I would be doing the same thing in Ottawa. But so it started there. Then Toronto opened one, Ottawa opened one. And for people who are not familiar with the concept, what it is basically the idea that you set up in a public space every day, you pop a tent, so hence the idea of a pop-up. So you pop up a tent that you will eventually take down or leave permanently, depending on your setting. For us, it was very much setting up and taking down every day. And then you operate an overdose prevention service for as long as you can with volunteers. And this is what we've been doing. And this is how it got started. And so we would basically provide very basic things like naloxone training, distribution of supplies, and just a basic tent where people could safely come and feel welcome and take their time and split their drugs and also, you know, just then use and not be alone. And then if ever something happens, then you have volunteers there that are there to either monitor the person, to stimulate them, you know, calling their name, asking them to take deep breaths, And if ever that person stops breathing and becomes unconscious, you can administer naloxone and connect them with emergency services. So that's how it works. It's as simple as that. We've managed to do it. And because of that, created a standard where that service can now is now operating across two provinces in Ontario and British Columbia.
It's just incredible. It's so hard to believe, again, that people have just got together and done this. It's so inspiring. It really is.
Yeah. And then I would say, I mean, I think what I've learned from this, and it's been interesting coming at it with my experience initially as I did pre-hospital training. So I was working on ambulances before becoming a nurse. Then I was an emergency and trauma nurse. So it was interesting coming at it from that background and looking at how impactful it is to provide a service where people can just feel safe and they don't have to rush. And it's been interesting how so much attention has been put on naloxone. But when you talk to people who work in overdose prevention sites, they also say that the impact is because people can take their time. Because when you're rushing and you have, you know, this, you have your drug and you can't really take your time and split that and say, you know what, I'm just going to do half. I'll wait a little bit. I'll do another half, because you're for sure going to use it all and as quickly as possible just to make sure that cops don't, you know, find that on you. And that alone reduces overdoses so much, just because people are able to slow down and they feel safe in that space, right? So that is super powerful.
It's such a simple but crucial point, isn't it? Allowing autonomy, someone's decision making on how they're going to consume. It's something that, do you reckon that point alone, I was going to ask you what reaction you've had both from drug consumers and that sector, but also in regards to people that aren't remotely interested in drug policy, you know, it just doesn't enter their radar. What kind of mix of reactions have you had off of pop-up sites?
I think every city had a different experience with it. For us, I would say what was amazing is the community of people who use drugs, that community in that neighborhood of people who are experiencing homelessness, who really kind of were in the neighborhood that we set up in. They really were excited about this. They couldn't believe it. They were so impressed. Like they were just like, especially the first few days, asking us like, is this for real? Like, who are you? Can I really come in? Like, are you sure? Like, is something going to happen to me? And who are you guys? Right. And we were a bunch of very diverse people and absolutely not like a healthcare provider background. Like we had very few nurses. The rest were people that cared, people that were either directly impacted, had lost somebody to an overdose, or people who just really cared about their community and wanted to volunteer. And just a lot of people that are just really involved in social justice movements. And we had food every single day. So we operated for 80 days, and every single day we had a homemade cook meal, home cooked meal, for like our volunteers and our guests that were coming to our site. And people just showed up. Like, it was so nice to actually see when you do something right and people recognize that, they show up. I've had people pay for my lunch at restaurants like that recognize me and said like, oh, you're this nurse who's involved in the pop-up, let me pay for your lunch. And you know, the negative reaction was so minor, but I have to point out one thing though, is that it was very minor, but media played it up a lot. And unfortunately, I feel that when it comes to issues like that, that really requires some careful reporting, solid background, fact-checking, you know, the kind of really rigorous journalism, unfortunately, was not always there. And that led to very polarizing representation of what was happening. Unfortunately, the very small group that were hostile towards our site got a lot of airtime.
This has been a point that we've addressed previously, is that the media has a big responsibility in this. And if they're not addressing this, because what they try and do, and you can understand, is that they go for this word balance, don't they? They want to go that 50-50 approach of giving equal airtime. But if it's a disproportionate view and that there is a minority that's putting a push against it versus 90% of people that are for it, then that isn't representation, is that? That's a distorting the picture. So how much of the media has influenced this? What has been the reaction broadly within media circles?
Well, I would say, again, like, it depends a bit of, like, your local context. You know, I think if I look at the coverage in British Columbia, it was a bit more, I would say, informed and grounded in a context with a bit more kind of an education piece. I think because there's so much harm reduction happening, you know, maybe that helped. For us, I mean, the two things that I've noticed in this process was, for example, the importance of setting the, like, the stage for what's happening. For example, like, our site was not the first one. It was actually the 26th overdose prevention site to open by the time that we opened. But media would often represent this as, like, we're doing this thing that no one else is doing in the country, you know, which I think for the public is important to know, right? If you have a sense that, like, a bunch of people are showing up in a park and doing this every day and it's kind of completely random, your opinion might change. And if you're like, what? This is happening and it's been done and it's really impactful and can actually contribute to our community and saving lives, and it's been done elsewhere, you're like, oh, okay, you know, like, it's that difference. And also, like, the point I would say that really ended up creating work for us, but good work in the sense of now we have a document to work with, is we ended up working with lawyers who helped tackle the question of these sites being illegal versus unsanctioned. So media really kind of jumped on the idea that what we were doing, we were breaking the law. And that really kind of, like, started this narrative of law breaking people and what you're doing is wrong and you're not following the rules, as opposed to actually we're forced to not go through the sanctioning process that is normally required to open a safer consumption space in Canada because there is an emergency and no one is responding to it. We're forced to do that, but we're not breaking the law. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of one point that, yeah. So we ended up working on this quite a bit.
But this is what's fascinating to me as well, is that overdose prevention sites aren't an uncommon factor in your country, are they? You've had them. You've had safe consumption rooms, haven't you, for a little while?
Yeah.
How long have you actually had? Because, again, this is something that we're just about having a conversation with here now in the UK, especially in Scotland, in Glasgow. It's been dubbed the overdose centre of Europe because, you know, that is where all the action is happening and people are dying. Do you think that the previous drug consumption rooms you had have had any kind of segue into the sort of harm reduction and pop-up sites? Are they related at all?
Yes, in the sense of, you know, we've had InSight, the supervised injection site, open in 2003. It was then, you know, ended up in the Supreme Court of Canada, which then kind of created the framework that we're still stuck with. And that framework under, like, a conservative government become very heavy, very, like, much like about red tape, making it really hard to open one. And then when the Liberals came into power, they really tried to, in their words, streamline this process to make it easier to open a safer consumption space in the country. But it still requires, like, a lot of work to open one, despite whatever they did to streamline it. Like, I mean, when you talk to people who go through this process, it's very work intensive. It actually requires community consultation, which is something that should not be part of the process, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of people in this country. But, you know, it's hard. And I think the overdose prevention sites were a direct response to the fact that the current system does not allow for safer consumption spaces to be open very quickly to address a public health emergency. And you can wait years to open one. And it's not like a system that works fast and allows for lives to be saved right here and now. So the overdose prevention sites are actually very connected in the sense that they were a direct response to the failures of that system and the need for rapid action and the need for very simple actions in the here and now, right? And so they're very much connected. And I think what that has created is pressure to try to get things done more quickly and also an opening for these services to be implemented more quickly in different settings without a requirement that is the same as, for example, originally intended, like for Insight, you know, a bureaucracy standpoint.
Can you give me the statistic? Because I still think that people are going to be surprised by this. But to date, how many people have died when there has been an overdose prevention site or a safe consumption room present?
Well, I would say, oh, you mean in those spaces or?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We haven't had a death
exactly.
in any of the safer consumption spaces. And that's true across the world, right? And I think by now, internationally, like we should have, I remember a systematic review that was published in 2016. They were saying we had 90 safer consumption spaces in the world. But I think with Canada adding so many, we're like way above 100 and people don't die in these spaces. They just don't. So I think that's important to note, you know, in terms of it's pretty simple. And the solutions we know what they are. We just need to do it.
Am I right in thinking as well that I saw recently that there is the first in-hospital drug consumption room?
Yeah, and I had a chance to visit, it's at the Royal Alexander Hospital in Edmonton, in Alberta. And they've actually integrated a safer consumption space in their hospital. And there is also, so that's the first, for sure. And it's, you know, it looks the same as the other safer consumption spaces. But it allows for people who are in the hospital to go use in that space and also connect with the staff there. There's interestingly also with the overdose prevention site model being out there, St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver also has an overdose prevention site outside its hospital that is peer run. So that's also an option. Those are two examples again of like when people say, oh, this can't be done. Well, I like to think that once someone has done it, you can then turn and say, actually, it can be done. So my hope is that by these two very, I would say, courageous hospitals that are like, you know, really responsive to the needs of the patients that are there and, you know, are applying, I would consider this like an evidence-based approach and are doing the right thing, that they can serve as role models for the rest of Canada, and we can then push other hospitals to do the same.
I don't even think just for Canada. I think that we've got a lot of eyes on what's going on in your region, because that we're quite similar countries in the sense that we've, you know, we've both got healthcare, and it doesn't make any sense to us that we're not progressing the conversation around drug consumption rooms further with regards to our politicians, because we know that healthcare works, we know that looking after society as a holistic realm also works, and yet we're still not quite grasping how harm reduction has got benefits to all of us. So could you just speak, if you can, about how these reforms not only benefit obviously real lives and people that have had their lives saved, but also how it benefits communities as well?
Yeah, and well, you know, for sure, the idea with any kind of harm reduction services, people always think that it's going to create more like crime, or, you know, like that it's going to bring people to areas where they're not usually. And I think we've proven by now that it's not true, that actually people just want a safe place to exist and to access services and to find their community. And that when you provide that, it actually improves community safety overall for everybody, right? Not just for some, but for everybody. That it doesn't increase crime, that people, you know, when we open safer consumption spaces or programs or services, like it's where people are at already. So we're not like kind of creating suddenly like an influx of people, right? Like they're there. You provide the service where people are and you meet them where they're at. So that's always kind of something that I find is people suddenly realize, oh yeah, it hasn't changed anything really in my neighborhood. Actually, it has improved it. So I think people need to see it from their own eyes, and they do change their mind. You know, even with our overdose prevention site in Ottawa, like a neighbor that was very strongly opposed to our site initially ended up doing a complete 360 and then came to us and hugged every volunteer and said, like, I can't believe I used to think so negatively about this, and I'm so impressed with the work you're doing. And then he ended up being trained with naloxone and left with a naloxone kit. So I truly believe in the power of seeing it with your own eyes, connecting with people, getting real education and not sensationalist kind of coverage, And actually connecting, you know, with the service providers, the peers, and just making this like connection one-on-one and understanding at a human level. So I believe that that's what we've been seeing. What else? What have we seen? I mean, your question that, like, do you want me to expand in terms of even like the health impact or?
Yeah, any kind of expansion you got on the point, it really helps our conversation here.
Yeah. Well, I would say these services in general have been proven also to work in terms of then people, once that they're connecting to a service, we know that the likelihood of them maybe addressing some of their health issues or maybe looking at starting treatment, which is not something that, you know, we always work with that goal in mind, but the likelihood of them starting treatment, if people who are really, really care about treatment, let's say, like, that's really their where they feel passionate about, they should really care about harm reduction, because harm reduction is the best way for people to actually access and start treatment. And we see an increase when you have these harm reduction services, we see an increase in uptake of treatment, because you need a starting point and harm reduction is a starting point. And then people can start connecting, you know, with services for their housing and social services, and maybe reconnect with their families or, you know, address their food insecurity and work on things that are really important for their health. But it's really hard to do that if you don't have kind of like that bridging, which again, like harm reduction is really about that too. It's a starting point. It's a building a bridge. And it's really hard to get people to, you know, a point of maybe doing something like taking care of a wound if you are not doing really good harm reduction in the first place and connecting and building relationship and trust. So I think we can see impact at the level of health, at the level of the community, at the level of safety, but also if people, for example, especially politicians that are very much interested in cost saving, I would say if that's the angle that you're really interested in, which, you know, is really not mine, but, you know, it's like an added benefit, I would say, because anybody who's looking at this from a financial standpoint is very much cost saving and cost effective. And there is no doubt about that. There's enough research out there to show how much money is saved when you actually do prevention and connect with people and provide their services versus waiting for them to get really ill or overdose and then require potentially like an ICU admission or something. So there's all these benefits really. And it's not like there's a ton of benefits and I would say not a lot of negative impacts out there. Unfortunately, I think we just need to do a lot of education to make sure, that, you know, that people understand this and that they're not kind of amplifying the potential risk or negative impact when in fact there's not going to be any, but people really like to emphasize that based on their preconceived ideas.
I wrote an article about how cost-effective in this country and using examples of Canada, and it's cost-effective to the government coffers. And it strikes me again, if no other arguments resonate on saving lives, the fact that we've had, you know, no deaths, surely cost effectiveness is something that can resonate with someone that's potentially skeptical about these moves.
Yeah, and then surprisingly it's often not enough, right? Because I think what we're dealing with is ideas that are very much grounded in you know, drugs are bad, abstinence is the goal, we shouldn't, like, you know, kind of facilitate anything with respect to drug use. And, you know, prohibition, like, drugs are illegal for a reason, they're bad. And I would say, so those are the ideas that we're kind of facing. Often that takes over any kind of rational thinking, because it is based on values and a certain understanding of the world and ideology. So that's harder to change. I find the economic financial arguments can often just be an entry point to then expose a problematic line of thinking. So, for example, we could be saving this much money. So as a public servant, as someone who's having to handle, like, and make decisions with respect to where we spend our public money, you have to be held accountable. And why would you waste kind of this money when you could also invest in a better ethical kind of approach that delivers results, but also really saves lives and you know, also saves money. So I think it can be used in a way to just expose the fact that you're making decisions based on things that are not evidence-based and that are purely value and ideology-based, and that is problematic if you're a public servant. If you have been elected to, you know, work for the society as a whole and not just a certain subpopulation, you know, that doesn't use drugs, for example. So I think it can be used kind of strategically to kind of expose how irresponsible it is and unethical. And, you know, so I think that can be used in that way.
And as you said as well, it's fascinating the fact that if we frame this all around the drug itself, it can potentially put people's backs up that are a little bit cynical to the issue. But it's more than that, isn't it? As you've just said, you're providing meals as well. You're providing potential first level outreach of someone on their, you know, we don't want to potentially promote recovery, because it's again for the autonomous individual to decide that themselves, whatever route they need to take. But the fact that you are managing to get vulnerable people into a conversation as well, and just being part of society again, that is just the most purest form of just outreach, isn't it?
Yeah. And everyone, I mean, we should strive for everyone to be included, to have access to their basic necessities, to have their needs met, to feel safe. You know, we shouldn't put people in jail for things that, you know, are starting from a place of trauma or, you know, mental illness. Like, we should approach everything, I feel, with compassion, with also evidence and the proper experts, and listening to the needs of people who are in that position and say, what do you need? Like, what can we do for you? And at the end, that return on investment will be huge. And we just need people that are, you know, also serving, that have that, you know, that understand this. So I do think that we need education, and we need to make almost like this a mandatory training for all elected official to have a basic level of knowledge and understanding of social issues and health issues if they're going to make decisions about them, and not to kind of assume that, you know, because they were elected, they're necessarily qualified to make all the decisions and to be proactively kind of educating them. And then if they are educated and are still making those decisions, then, you know, I think you can really point that out, and that's problematic. But I do think that we need to work on that as well, like the general level of knowledge. And I can speak from my own professional community within the nursing community. Like, it's hard to point the finger at politicians sometimes when I look at my own professional group and I look at nurses and how they think and how they treat people who use drugs. I think we have to also kind of start where we can start. And for me, it starts with also in healthcare and doing my part to change those mentalities, because really, we also have a lot of work to do in that sector as well.
That's certainly a remit that we understand as well, because obviously within Law Enforcement Action Partnership, we're there to have a conversation with the police and law enforcement services. And we're starting to find, especially in the UK, that more and more law enforcement voices are starting to question current policies. There's a lot more proactive voices that are actually doing things on the ground under some quite tricky conditions as well. And you're right, this surely needs all services to join up and have these mutual conversations of, you know, let's not arrest our way out of a problem, let's not, you know, create a stigma as well, because this must be something that you have to see and address as well, is that word stigma.
Yeah, exactly. And it's huge. That's going to be a huge piece of work, because really it is, as long as drugs are criminalized, it will be hard to change things, I would say. And that's why in Canada, we've been really in the past year, advocating strongly for drug decriminalization. I think you have to completely disconnect that the drug use and the way we approach that from the law enforcement side of things. It will be really hard to work within the current system. It is so harmful to people, and it is killing people. I mean, you know, when people are like, oh, fentanyl is killing people, it's like, no, prohibition is killing people. Fentanyl, if it's not fentanyl, it will be something else. And it's just how we set up this system. And so I think we really have to look at this and work towards it. And for us, what's been interesting in Canada, though, and I think that is good for an international audience as well to hear what's happening on that side of things here. But it's we've had two political parties where the membership have voted to pass a resolution for drug decriminalization. So that's pretty huge. And that's in the last year alone. And we've had a few cities also publicly calling for drug decriminalization. We have in British Columbia also like a willingness to do the work and see how we can do that provincially when, I mean, the reality is that this is a federal issue. This is a national issue when it comes to the Criminal Code and the Control and Substances Act. So so there's that piece, but I think it's very much needed at this point. And it will be hard to do that kind of real change without removing drug use from the crime piece completely.
There's no getting away from it, is there? Criminalization equals stigma. And hopefully this is a conversation that we're going to have here in the UK more and more. But how is it going there? What do you think? You've given us quite a good overview of the decriminalisation process. Do you think that it could get there? Do you think that within the next couple of years we can be having this conversation and it will be decriminalised?
I hope so. I feel that if there is a time, it is now. The movement is, you know, we're building a strong movement calling for that here. Coupled with also like the call for a safer drug supply, which, you know, is also became very strong yesterday with the release of those two documents, especially one coming from an institute that is, you know, known for producing guidelines and things like that. So I'm curious to see the impact of that. It will be challenging in the sense of we have a federal elections coming up this year. And whatever government is elected will be stuck with that government for 4 years. And, you know, what's going on in Canada right now is a bit scary at times, just because provincially we've gone through a few elections where very conservative governments have been elected. So I think we're going to be mobilizing to make sure that the outcome of that election is, in, you know, going to be supportive of harm reduction. So that could also be a big game changer. But what's interesting, though, is that, you know, when the membership of those of two of major parties here are saying we support direct decriminalization. So that's some pressure on the leadership of those parties. It's going to be a tricky election issue to come to take on, to be honest. But the pressure needs to be there. And right now, there hasn't been a signal from the current party that is in government right now that they're willing to go there. But, you know, it's going to be a matter of putting the pressure and making sure that it's part of the conversation leading to the elections.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
From my perspective, it just kind of think, why aren't you having that conversation more? Because, you know, Trudeau, first country in the G7 to legalize cannabis. So surely the next step is a fuller decriminalization model.
But you know what's interesting, and that's been my thinking around, because I am doing some of the work on the impact of the legalization of cannabis on people who live with HIV. And you know, it's been interesting though, because we didn't really engage in a conversation of decriminalizing cannabis before legalizing. So we kind of jumped into the legalizing piece of it, and especially because I think it provided this kind of opportunity to create a market, to profit from it, to regulate it. But we didn't really do that kind of like decriminalization piece at all. And so if you look at the legislation in the country, like people can still go to prison. So for example, if you try to sell cannabis to a minor, you could serve up to 14 years in prison still. So I think that criminalizing piece is still very much in there, even though we've legalized cannabis. So that's where I find it problematic, is that I think legalization of cannabis is a good example of why decriminalization needs to be done first. So if we had done that, for example, first with cannabis before legalizing it, that would have, for example, stopped the arrests that are associated with cannabis. People would not have been going to prison, and their criminal record would have been like erased, for example. Like, so these are the conversations around decriminalization that should be happening, should have happened, that are not really, I mean, done right now, and we've legalized. So I think that's a good example of why decriminalization is so important. Because it still kind of shapes our thinking around cannabis, whether we like it or not. So.
And that's where it's really helpful to us to follow what lessons you've learned within this, because the drug law reform movement is quite strong here, as it will be across, because we get a lot of listeners in the United States as well, and obviously state by state their legalization process is going through. But the conversation around criminalization can sometimes get put to the back burner in favor of kind of big business legalization. And have you found that has Canada gone more of a business approach, more than a public health approach on their cannabis legalization?
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people would agree with that point, is that we kind of missed that step of engaging in that, I would say, a trickier, probably like messier conversation around like the criminalization of people who've used cannabis, who've, you know, were selling cannabis or whatever in the past pre-legalization, and are still, that hasn't changed for them, you know. And what I'm seeing as well, for example, where I think over time this might change, but initially a lot of the cities came up with very strict policies around, for example, there's not going to be any space to go and smoke. So basically you can't smoke anywhere. If suddenly also like condos and apartment buildings are coming up with very strict regulations where you could actually lose your housing if you're found to be smoking cannabis, whereas before like people did it. And so legalization has kind of like opened the door for example, also workplaces to start testing their employees. So through legalization, we've seen, okay, like housing is becoming an issue. There's really no place now where you can actually smoke. And I know people don't just smoke it, but I mean, the reality is that edibles were not included in the initial piece of legislation. Right now, vaping it or smoking it, like there's no space that's been designed for it. And then your workplace can start testing you for it. And then like police are doing road checks very aggressively. And so you have all these things, right? So legalization has brought that. And so that often will push people to, for example, like use in their car because they have nowhere to do it, or it will lead to targeting of the same population that we know are already being targeted. For example, if you're homeless and you're smoking weed, you could be ticketed. So now we have tickets, for example, in Victoria, the city that I'm in, I think it's a $100 ticket. So legalization has also kind of brought that. So legalization is not the answer to everything. I think if you're still in a frame of mind of drugs are bad, and we're going to look for people who use them, and we're going to like control and punish them in some way, it's not going to be ideal. And this is what we're faced with in Canada.
Can I be nosy as well and ask that you just mentioned about the work you're doing with this subject and HIV as well? Can I ask what that's about?
Yeah, I mean, my work in HIV, that's been most of my research and my career, and I've moved from looking at the experience of people who have side effects and have symptoms and are trying to manage them to look at who's using cannabis for that purpose, so for more therapeutic purposes, but outside the medical cannabis kind of system. Because for a lot of people, that system is not accessible. Often physicians don't want to prescribe. It doesn't work for them. So they often have gone through the route of using cannabis on their own for therapeutic purposes. And I'm curious to see what's going to happen to people who are doing that pre-legalization, what's going to happen to them post-legalization. So I got money to do a longitudinal study and to interview the same people for 3 years. Every year, talk to them and see, okay, you were using cannabis for maybe a bit of recreational purposes, but primarily because it made you feel better and allowed you to manage your symptoms. And post-legalization, what does that look like for you? And then another year, what does that look for you now? How has that changed? And then a year later, so I'm going to have 3 years worth of interviews talking to people because I'm very interested about, again, the kind of unintended effect of legalization, especially for a group of people who were really counting on cannabis to help them manage symptoms that often like healthcare providers don't really help them manage very well.
It's amazing the parallels that we've got between our conversations because this is something going on as we speak about the UK have kind of got medicinal cannabis now, but in practice it's completely prohibited still because it's going through weird systems that I won't get into now. But it's completely fascinating to hear what you just said there, that Canada did have a medical marijuana system. Can you just briefly touch upon how that worked and how it potentially didn't work and how it led to where we are now
for the medical system?
Yeah.
For people. I mean, I'm definitely not necessarily an expert in all the specifics of it, but what I'm hearing from people in terms of why it doesn't work is that first you have to go through a physician. And that physician kind of like is a gatekeeper for accessing medical cannabis. And so then you're tackling like, you know, all the attitudes that physicians have towards cannabis, the fact that physicians often like base their practice on guidelines. There's, you know, been for many years now, a lot of guidelines out there to help them with their practice. They often think that, you know, in their mind, they're also trained to think that way, that, you know, I can prescribe a pill for your nausea. Cannabis is really effective for you. So things like that. So that's the first barrier. Then through that program, you would be restricted to whatever the government produces. So in terms of your access to various products and maybe ways of consuming your cannabis that works for you, like you would be limited in terms of your options. And, you know, depending on where you live, things like that for access would be a bit trickier. And so when I talk to people and what kind of sparked my interest in studying this post-legalization is that people were saying how the current system does not work for me. So I'm better served, you know, by myself just to find a dealer that I can work with and just find a product that works for me. And then I can actually eliminate a lot of my medications and I feel overall better. And so that's where the questioning started for me. And I wondered how this kind of group of people is doing post-legalization, because right now what this has created for them is that if they want to use, let's say, legally, in quotation mark, really, is that they have to buy it from the government. And right now that access is not that great. It's pretty expensive. Most of it is online. So it requires all sorts of like IDs and being able to pick it up, and Canada Post will not deliver to your house if you're not there. There's like all these things. So yes, you know what you're buying a bit more. You can maybe make more of an informed decision in that way, but it's expensive. For 1 gram, for example, 2 pre-rolled joints, it was $26.86 when I tested the system myself. And so, yeah, I mean, it's hard if you want to do it in through that route as someone who maybe is using it for therapeutic purposes and require maybe more of an amount that is would really be expensive versus someone who uses it recreationally. And then it also kind of exposes them to more severe punishment if they don't are not going the legal route. So I think it's going to be interesting. There's really nothing that's been done like that before. So I'm curious to see and how what we can learn from people living with HIV for then people who live with chronic illnesses in general and are in the same situation.
Yeah, please share the results with us on that, because that's going to be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and then that for me, physicians are the gatekeepers of access to cannabis for people who desperately need it and would benefit tremendously from it. And to, you know, I think we would be better off trying to like kind of go around that gatekeeping, because, you know, just focusing on like it has to be through a physician, then we have to work like really hard to change those mentalities. And I think we would be better off to actually provide people with option, and they should be able to make decisions from themselves.
So I'm going to start to wrap up now, because I can't believe I had an hour and I need like another 3 hours with you, because you've just been honestly amazing. I can't thank you enough for just how much you've given us on this. If you could speak briefly about naloxone distribution, why it's so crucial, and what your experience is within that field.
Yeah, and it's great because you've been referring to Scotland, and I had the pleasure of going there in August and speaking at the Scottish Drugs Forum. So it's really been great because all the examples that you're referring to, I'm very aware of. So that's great. Yeah, I would say naloxone distribution has been interesting in Canada because it has been implemented differently across each province. So we don't have like a national Canada-wide naloxone distribution approach. Every province has had its own, you know, approach to it, own system, which has resulted with like a wide range of access to naloxone depending on where you live. So we've had, I would say, at the two end of the continuum, British Columbia, for example, where naloxone is distributed in the hospital, can be distributed by peers and community-based organizations. Like they're doing training in bars. Like it's widely distributed, widely accessible. They have training online. They have a take on naloxone program. There's a lot of naloxone kits available. And my first naloxone kit was actually a kit from BC, from British Columbia, because I lived in Quebec at the time, and Quebec went the opposite route, where it is a very controlled distribution, where you, with very long training, like a whole afternoon of training, and only a few pharmacies would deliver it. You know, it was like a very limited, and you would have to explain that you use an opiate or that you use drugs and you need a ID card, like your health card, all these things. So I saw the both extremes. So I did like a piece in the media in the summer of 2017, where I went with a journalist to different pharmacies and I tried to access a naloxone kit in Montreal and Quebec, and it was impossible. And so I did a lot of kind of using the fact that I was in a province that limited access to naloxone to say, hey, I can't get a kit, and did a lot of media around that. And so that's kind of like the range in the country. And even though Quebec has changed slightly, it's still not ideal. It's still hard to get. So I would say that's the range of naloxone distribution approaches overall. I would say everyone who wants it should get it. Training should not be hard. You should not have to provide an ID card or your healthcare card. You should not have to pay for it. And I think the approach should be a bit like the defibrillators that we have in airports and hockey arenas and libraries, where, you know, we really don't expect people who are going to be handling a defibrillator in the context of a cardiac arrest to do CPR, to certify, to spend like an afternoon in training, to show that they've actually know what to do. We expect them to follow kind of these basic steps, and we calculate that it's worth someone maybe doing it imperfectly because they will save a life than kind of obsessing over like making this complicated. So I would say naloxone needs to be the same as a defibrillator. We should also have naloxone in almost like a little box, similar to defibrillator in public spaces, including libraries and bars and cafes and universities. And it should pretty much be a standard now. And there are ways also of kind of addressing maybe the fact that the defibrillator kind of gives you instructions. And in the States, they have that pre-packaged naloxone syringe that gives you instructions that paramedics are using there. So there's also ways of kind of addressing the fact that people would not even have to go through training if we put them in those public spaces. But there's really no reason to make it hard, complicated, or even expensive, I would say. And everyone that needs it, wants it, should have it. That's kind of my stance on things.
I don't want to turn this into a ghoulish question because it's going to sound almost, because again, we need to reinforce, we're talking about real lives here, real people that have got families. But I've had it when I've had conversations on naloxone, because some people just don't know what it is. You know, it's still a fairly new conversation here. But if you say to people, oh, can you remember the scene in Pulp Fiction where Uma Thurman overdoses? Oh, yeah. And that tends to be their kind of their thought process experience around it. Have you actually administered or been around it when it's been administered?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in our overdose prevention side, we did have to administer it because we were operating an overdose prevention side. And of course, we had to intervene in the context of overdoses there. And, you know, we had nasal naloxone at this site. We also had injectable naloxone. So yeah, I've definitely seen it. I've trained all our volunteers in how to use it. I know how people like quickly can learn about this and their comfort level around it. There's really nothing you can do wrong with naloxone. Honestly, you know.
What's it like to the person that's had it administered to them? What experience will they go through?
Yeah, and that's where I think we are having conversations here around the harm reduction approach to naloxone administration, because often people will kind of go very much like Rambo naloxone, and that's kind of my own expression here of like really go over the top because they're nervous and they feel like they need to intervene aggressively. And naloxone takes time to act, so you need to give it like a good 3 minutes, and that's why you want people to feel comfortable doing rescue breathing, because that's what you should be doing to give a chance for the naloxone to kick in, right? Because you don't want to be giving too much, because what that will create is it will push someone into withdrawal. It'll push them into a very kind of hard experience physically. Like they'll experience like withdrawal symptoms, but very kind of acute rapidly. It will not be a pleasant experience. So giving naloxone shouldn't be harmful also. So saving a life is important, but you need to also make sure that you don't kind of go overboard and push that person into a situation of withdrawal, because what will end up happening is that person will then need to find to buy more drugs and actually find another opiate to then kind of like manage that withdrawal, and the risk of overdosing again is greater. So you do need to have a harm reduction approach to naloxone administration, and also a harm reduction approach in the sense of, for a lot of the people that we worked with, and I know that in supervised consumption sites across the country, that's the general consensus, that you can do so much with oxygen, with stimulation, and just with monitoring the person, that often you can actually work around someone who's breathing more slowly without giving naloxone. Where you really want to give naloxone is when the person stops breathing and they're unconscious. But if you have a bit of room to, you know, kind of work with the person and keep them awake and make sure, and you can always put that O2 saturation monitor on the finger that will tell you, is this person properly oxygenated? Like, and if you have that, you can really kind of take your time and work with the person. And this will be the most important way of showing that you care about them and that you want to work with them, and they will come back and they will, you know, trust you because they know that you get it and that you didn't give naloxone if it wasn't indicated.
That's become quite clear in the conversations that we've had, is that you're very good at acknowledging how the process is still being learned within your sectors as well. Like you said, needs to be almost a harm reduction approach to naloxone. That's really interesting to hear. So where do you think, with that in mind, the future's going within the broad conversation? If I was to have this conversation with you in, say, 3 years' time, what kind of conversations will we be having then?
Oh boy.
Just put you on the spot.
Oh, yeah, that's like a big question. I mean, I have a mixed feelings. Like, I'm very kind of hopeful and inspired, but I'm also very kind of pessimistic and discouraged. And I have like these two views that coexist in me, which at times makes it hard because I feel like I'm very inspired with what people around me have managed to do, like with very little resources, with their courage and creativity. And I'm like constantly inspired and amazed with what we can do. But at the same time, I do worry about the fact that this community that is kind of leading the way is becoming increasingly burnt out, and traumatized and stressed, and not a lot of they don't have a lot of like, unlimited resources to draw from. They're at the front line. I worry on like the longevity of it, the sustainability of the leaders and everyone in the community that's doing this work. So I do worry about that. But I feel like if we can find a way of like just building our strength and bring like more allies and really building a movement, that if we can work towards safe direct supply, drug decriminalization, and more expansion of harm reduction with less red tape, this is kind of where, for us, I see the next step. So I'm hopefully in 3 years would be looking back thinking we've achieved significant progress. I'm also, you know, a bit concerned about the government that's going to be elected next in Canada. So hopefully in 3 years, I would be talking about a government that is progressive and supportive of harm reduction. And I really hope that is the case, because for us, what we've learned is that if the federal government can really limit our work and capacity to bring change. And so hopefully there's that. And I would say what I'm hoping to contribute right now is my attention is very focused on supporting the nurses in the harm reduction community so that we can start retaining our nurses in that specialty, because there is a big turnover. People leave, so all that expertise leaves. So I'm trying to like focus on mentorship and support and training and changing the education of nurses around harm reduction. So that's like also a lot of work. So hopefully in 3 years, I would report back that we've made progress at that level, because we need to do better. Like, and I can only do my work in my own professional community, but I can say that nurses need to do better with respect to people who use drugs and the level of care that's provided to them and general approach. So I would say that's kind of like what I'm aiming to do
and
contribute to.
And we've had very brief conversations about the drug supply system. You know, in this country, we're talking about heroin-assisted treatment. We've mentioned before about fentanyl and how there potentially could be a regulation on that. How far along is that conversation, and do you think there's going to be any progress within it?
Well, I think that yesterday, those two reports coming out is like a huge step. There is unprecedented in terms of having that real conversation beyond just like, oh, this is what we need to call for, to like, this is how we're going to do it and this is what we need to do next. Like, that's the first time that I see something very concrete presented. And British Columbia will have to do something. I mean, it is faced with just like a completely out of control public health emergency, that there's no level of harm reduction right now that is slowing it down. And so I think it will need to take some drastic steps. I'm pretty confident that something will be done within the next year, and in the sense of like something more concrete. There is the momentum is there. The crisis is there. Like, we absolutely have exhausted all the other options. And if something happens, it's going to be in this province. So I'm glad that I'll get to, you know, be part of people that are putting pressure and witness whatever change comes for that. And I think the idea is this, yeah, we just need to provide people with a safer drug supply. It's as simple as that, really. And it's not that hard. And so I think this is the, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen here in this province. And it should happen as soon as possible. I mean, ideally yesterday, but you know, I think if there's anything that's going to happen, it's going to be here for sure. I think the only way that we can make progress internationally on this is to all work together and to make sure that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. If someone has done it, we should like take their stuff. We should all share and really share openly. I think that's been the thing that I've learned from our Canadian experience here, is that as long as people are open, they share. It's all about being strategic, working together. We can do so much.
So thank you so much for joining us on that. We've learned so much from you, and hopefully we will speak to you again very, very soon with some more progress and some more knowledge of like I said, you're a step ahead of us and we need to learn from that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So thank you so much for listening. And yes, I think you'll agree, amazing. Let's save some more lives. Let's get some lives saved in the UK. Let's save them in Europe. We need to, don't we? We really do. And as I now need to do our thank yous, which obviously thank you to Mary Lou for everything. And thank you to the two Johns. Thank you to John at Distractions for Pieces Network. Please listen to his podcast, The Dream Factory. Thank you to John Cross at Leap UK and our shout outs. If you want to find us on Twitter, at UK Leap. If you want to find us on Instagram, it's at UK Leap. Our Facebook, at ukleap.org, and our website at ukleap.org. Thank you to Tristan and Nikki, the producers. Without them, you'll be listening to radio silence or just me babbling into a dictaphone. And thank you so much to My Name Is Ad for all the artwork you do, making us look pretty. And of course, listen to the Distraction Pieces Network, all of them, brilliant shows, making some great podcasts out there. And I also need to thank you, everybody that shares this as well, because we've got some brilliant people out there that do share, subscribe, and do all the thumbs up and all that sort of thing. Especially George. Thank you so much, George, for everything you've been doing. You are one of our biggest fans, if I'm allowed to say that. Thank you so much. So if you can do that, if you're listening to this and you're enjoying what we're doing, if you can go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a nice review, it all helps. Right. I think that's it. If not, I apologise. But already got the next episode lined up. Sorry for the break in this one because there was a month delay. I won't bore you with the details, but on my word, everything went wrong. Laptops, health, you name it, it went wrong. But I think we should be back to regularity now. Right. Thank you so much again for listening. See you again soon. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray. Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.